I think of retreats as journeys, and any good journey has everything. Every journey has challenges, has its joys, has its dark times in the fog, clear times, things are clear. Times when we have to put in a lot of effort and work hard, times when it's kind of a breeze to come along. An example might be of a journey might be bicycling from here to Southern California down Highway 1. And I imagine that some of you might say, great, wonderful, and have confidence you can do it. And some of you may be have hardly biked in your life before and don't have any confidence that you could do it. And it seems like, wait a minute, you don't even, you know, you just maybe refuse because it's so much doubt that you can do it. But to set out and do a big journey like that, it really helps to have some confidence in one's ability to do the trip. And then as we do the trip, like that, biking down the coast, you have to put a lot of energy in. But not just a lot of energy, you know, you need to be able to monitor how much energy you put in. You have to kind of look ahead and know when to reserve energy and when to pick up speed to go uphill and when you have to really push hard. And when you get up to the top, you know that when you can coast for a while, maybe coast downhill, and you can conserve your energy, you can rest, and it's just like a breeze, just a, maybe it feels like surfing going down some of the downhills. And you know not to make, you know, you don't pedal as fast as you can when you're going downhill. It's a whole different way of applying effort. And then you have to be pretty mindful as you do the trip. Biking down 101, I think, is dangerous. One of the times in my life where I think back and say, I almost died, didn't I? was hitchhiking on Highway 1. Highway 1 down by Monterey. And I don't want to remember much more of that. But. And so anyway, you have to be pretty mindful and attentive to what's going on all around you, within you. You have to know that what's happening within you, make sure that you're rested and hydrated and fed and, you know when you're tired and when you need to rest, because otherwise it can be dangerous. You have to be able to monitor what's going on around you, what's on the road, the other cars, the other situation. You have to be able to monitor the potholes and what's ahead. And there's a lot of attending that has to happen. If you space out biking down Highway 1 to Southern California, you know, those cliffs are pretty high. So you better pay attention. And then you need to be pretty focused as well. So a certain degree of concentration needs to be there. It isn't just open awareness to everything. You have to hold the attention to where it really needs to be. You keep it on the road, keep it on the traffic, keep it what's coming up ahead. Maybe you have a rear view mirror, you have to kind of make sure you know what's going on. There's a lot of focus, a lot of attention. And again, you can't really let your attention waver too much because of the dangers that are there. And then there has to be a lot of wisdom or a lot of insight or discernment. You have to really be able to see clearly where the dangers are, where the safe places are. You have to see, well, up ahead there's gravel. I better be careful with the bike now. I should slow down. Now there's a lot of traffic. Now the roads are wet. And when it's wet and it's going downhill fast in a curve, watch out. That's another time I think back, oh, that was a close one for me. When my motorcycle went into a wet curve, and flipped away from under me, and what hit the ground first was my head. But I had a helmet on, and I was pretty banged up, but as far as I can tell, my brain is okay. Okay enough. And so I didn't have a lot of wisdom that day, but I didn't know about wet. The other thing I didn't know about wet, but my motorcycle, I think I was probably 16 or something. I didn't know that when it's raining and you come to a red light and put on the brakes, that the motorcycle doesn't stop. And it just sailed right through the intersection. It's glided through. So you have to pay attention, you have to have some wisdom, some insight, you have to be able discerning, see what's there and know how to handle it. These are the five faculties, what's called the five faculties. That there has to be some kind of confidence or faith in yourself, trust in what's happening. There has to be some effort applied. There has to be some attention to what's going on, some focus on what's going on, and discernment or wisdom or insight to what's happening, to really see clearly and learn what's happening and adjust accordingly. And these, as I said yesterday, these five faculties are needed for almost any activity you do. If you can probably analyze just about anything you do, I thought of analyzing for you how making oatmeal in the morning requires the five faculties. I just decided to spare you the exercise. But it needs to be there. So these five faculties are there, and they're very interesting what the name of them is in Buddhist language, Pali. They're called the Indriya. And Indriya is named after the god Indra, which in ancient India was the chief god, like the Zeus, the pantheon. It was the controlling god, the ruling god, that which had the power and control over this, I guess, the heavens or this world or something. And Indra, the god Indra, also was a dragon slayer, which sometimes in Western culture, European culture, the idea of being slaying the dragon, St. George and the dragon slayer, and the idea of slaying the evil dragon is kind of in the picture here. And so by calling these five faculties Indriya, things that are like the god Indriya, they're sometimes translated into English as the controlling faculties, because they control things. And that's very interesting, the idea of control. If you try to control your meditation, it's not going to be pretty. And I learned that the hard way. My early retreats that I sat, by the third day, I was a mess. Because when I meditated at home, I would meditate for 40 minutes, and I had such a hectic, stressed out life that all I needed to do was to sit down and do nothing to unwind a little bit. And I didn't know that that's all it was. I patted myself on the shoulder. There, Gil, you're a good meditator. You know, you can focus and get concentrated. And look, you're so much calmer now. You did a good job. I should take no credit for it. I just sat still and things unwound. But I didn't know that. So I came to retreat and I thought, well, I'm just going to do the same. I'll just apply myself and concentrate, and I'll be in some great state pretty quickly. And so I applied the same effort that I did. And the first few hours in the retreat, the same effect happened. I unwound, which was good. But then the unwinding that was going to happen stopped. You know, I did what was going to be easy to do. I didn't do it. It happened. And so then... But I still was, I thought I was in charge. And so I'll just do more of the same now, and I'll be even more concentrated. And I couldn't get concentrated. And so my strategy was to try harder. So I tried harder, which made things worse. So what you do, all I knew to do was to try harder. So I just really huffed and puffed and strained and, you know, thought if I just really grit my teeth, you know, then I could get concentrated. Well, that's the opposite of what you need to do to get concentrated. So I kept doing this for a couple of days, and by the third day, I was so miserable. I mean, all my issues, all my self-doubt, all my self-loathing, all everything, it was hopeless. So it was so bad that at some point I just gave up. I just gave up. It was like a rock bottom. And that's when my retreat started. And from there, when I'd given up, then something was able to unfold, and then I discovered how to make a very different kind of effort. I wasn't straining and pushing and trying to be the one in control. So in calling these five faculties the five controlling faculties, named after the great controlling God, these are the things that, in a sense, control the progress of practice, not you. And what we're doing is setting in place the conditions that support the unfolding of practice, rather than being the one in charge and huffing and puffing and engineering, just being the one who does it. So there is an aspect of meditation where we get out of our own way. There's a lot of effort that's made in meditation, but it's a very peculiar kind of effort that's not a willed effort or the doing effort of a doer. Like, I'm going to do it, it's up to me, I'm responsible. Some people are very successful with that mode, and they can do whole careers because they know how to apply themselves, they do hard work, and they're kind of in control. It doesn't really work so well in meditation to do that approach. And so what we're doing in meditation is kind of making space, relaxing, opening up, and creating the conditions that allows something deeper to operate, something deeper to unfold, that is not of our making. And so the conditions we're putting in place are the five faculties. We're allowing them, we're nurturing them, supporting them, encouraging them to be there in a way, in such a way that we're making space for something to unfold. So even for mindfulness, think of mindfulness more as a creating breathing room and to allow something to happen. Without that sense of allowing, it's claustrophobic. We kind of, you know, it's hard for anything to happen. So I like the metaphor of growing plants. If you grow a plant in a greenhouse and you keep it dark, it doesn't grow. Or if you keep it kind of really confined in some kind of small space, it can't grow either. But you need to kind of pull the blinds from the greenhouse and let the light shine down, and then nurture the plant to grow. You can't stand and pull the top of the plant. You grow, get longer now. You know, you have to kind of nourish it. You water it and give nutrients to it, make sure it has light, and then the plant will grow. So the same thing with us. It's the Dharma plant in us that we're nourishing and creating the conditions for something to unfold, rather than us being the doer. We're the nurturer. We're the gardener for what's in there. We're not the, you know, in charge exactly. So these five faculties are what's in charge, oddly enough. And so how do you support the arising of these faculties? So sort of first is to know them so you can recognize them. The first one is, in Pali, the word is sada. Sanskrit is shraddha. And it's usually translated into English as faith. Some people love the word faith. I'm kind of that. I don't love it, but it makes me kind of warm. I have a positive association with the word. There are people who have very negative associations with the word and don't want to get even close to it. And so it's, you know, variable. You know, it's optional how we translate some of these words into English. Some people prefer the word confidence. And there's a good argument to be made that that's actually a better translation for what the original means. Some people translate it as trust, and I like trust as well. But whatever it is, faith, confidence, trust, it's in that domain. So you can kind of choose among those words what speaks to you the most, rather than, you know, going along necessarily with my choice. And I'll probably kind of vary what I say as I go along. Faith has a very important role, number of roles. And the first one I'll mention is that in the ancient texts, they liken faith to a magical gem. And if you drop that magical gem into muddy water, all the mud will settle and the water becomes clear. And that metaphor is supposed to be applied to the mind. That one of the functions of this faith or confidence or trust is to settle the agitation of the mind, the mud of the mind, to let something settle down. So what is it? What kind of faith, what kind of trust or confidence allows you or is an antidote to a certain kind of inner agitation, worry, doubt, fear, being all stirred up about things? How do you get stirred up in your life that you're kind of spinning around and concerned and anxious and you can't get quite settled? So you probably have your own answer to that. But in terms of faith or trust or confidence, to know that you can go into any situation and find your way means that no matter where you go, you don't have to be so worried about what you step into. You'll find your way. To have confidence and trust that you know how to navigate can settle a lot of things. For those of you who've done a lot of retreats, you probably have enough confidence or faith in yourself and the retreats to not worry about some of the things that you were anxious about when you came on your first retreat. I can't do that. I can't believe I'm going to be silent for 7 days. That must be impossible. And this thing about getting up early every morning and the oatmeal. How's that going to go? And then my body, how's that going to hold up? And, you know, I'll probably be stir crazy. After doing a few retreats, you find out, well, actually, I can do this. Actually, the silence is actually kind of nice. I can find my way with it. I actually find that getting up early in this context works well. And so forth, the various things. And yes, my body hurts, but I've learned that the body will hurt the first few days. I'll be tired the first couple of days or so. And that seems to be part of the normal pattern. And now that I know it's the pattern, I have confidence or trust that I can manage through it gracefully. I can practice with it the best I can. And I know that my practice doesn't look good the first few days, but I have trust that the fact that I'm practicing makes a difference. So I don't have to worry about my mind is wandering a lot. I don't have to be so upset that I haven't reached some stage of, you know, concentration by the second sitting. I don't have to measure every little sitting about how am I doing? Am I doing it right? I don't have to even be doing it right for the practice to unfold, amazingly enough, on a retreat. So you're in a powerful situation, conditions here. So after a while, doing a few retreats, a person has that confidence or that trust or that faith, I can make this work. This will work out. And because of that, they're much calmer, more settled. And certain degree of being stirred up and anxious is no longer there. In fact, some people who've done a number of retreats will come into the retreat center, and just walking into their front door, something settles and calms down immediately. Their body shifts and changes and relax, their mind settles, because they have so much confidence at what happens here that they can kind of like, almost like, oh, and here I'm safe. Here I know I can find my way in a way that, you know, maybe you don't at work or in other situations. So one of the functions of confidence is to help us feel secure, settle, like we have a way forward. For me, one of the most powerful forms of trust or confidence that I discovered through this practice in probably what I think is the most, you know, probably one of the biggest gifts I've had in my life is confidence in mindfulness. I have so much trust in showing up and being present in a mindful way for what's happening. Because I've seen over and over again that if I can be mindful in situations, I will find my way. Or sometimes I don't find the way finds its way. There's something powerful for me about just showing up and starting to pay attention. There's many situations I come to, I don't know what's supposed to happen. I don't know what I'm supposed to say in a conversation. And I don't worry about it too much anymore, because I know that if I just relax and just look around, pay attention, see what's going on, take my time, sometimes I need a little time for this to work. And just like, what's happening here? And start noticing what's happening, notice what's happening, what's here. Sometimes it's with other people. It's enough to do mindfulness out loud. I'll just say, well, this is what I'm aware of right now. And this is what's happening now, isn't it? This is what's happening. And somehow, in that clear recognition and recognizing what's here, something inside begins to shift and move and transform or reveal or to be discovered. And lo and behold, the way forward is found. I didn't find it, but somehow the act of being mindful helped me find it, helped the finding find itself. So this has given me a lot of confidence to walk in almost any place at all and not be anxious and not be concerned. I've gone into many difficult, fiery places and things that I would have been petrified when I was young. When I was in college, I used to disassociate if I had to go sit and visit a professor. It was pretty, challenging for me that. Which is, looking back now, it seems kind of silly, but, I've come a long way. So this confidence in the mindfulness. Some people have a broader confidence in the practice more generally, the kind of the range of practices we do, not just mindfulness, but loving kindness. Some people have confidence in the power of compassion and to hold oneself in compassion. Some people have confidence in this practice because they've learned through it. They learned through the teachings of Buddhism, the degree to which the source of suffering lays within ourselves in a certain attitude or way of being, clinging, grasping, attachment is at the heart of how we suffer. And so to really know that, instead of vaguely or not so vaguely, blame the world for how we're feeling, blame other people, not to blame ourselves, and not to dismiss that we should be concerned what people do out in the world, that some things people do are wrong, but to have confidence that for myself personally, if I want to find my way through this, that I have to really get quiet and go deep inside and find out what am I attached to? What am I holding on to? And I might not know what it is, but I have confidence that it's there. And I have confidence that I could practice. It may take a while. I can practice in such a way to uproot it, to find it, discover what it is, to dissolve it. Sometimes it takes months or years for me to work through certain things that I have, but I love it that I have a practice. I feel so fortunate that I've discovered a practice that is a way through it. And for me, that inspires me so much that it doesn't matter sometimes that the process has been slow. And in Buddhism, there's this wonderful idea that just to discover the practice is one of the greatest gifts of a lifetime. And that comes to the second function of the sadha, faith, confidence, trust. And that is to inspire people to practice. And in the ancient texts, one of the primary, faith in this ancient tradition is not believing something like a creed or, you have to kind of believe the tenets of Buddhism or something. It's a kind of faith or trust or confidence that gives rise to action, to do something. It inspires you. And the core thing is to practice, to come on retreat, to meditate, to be mindful, to be kind, to practice compassion, to practice letting go of the holding that we're the grip that we have on things. So what kind of confidence, what kind of trust puts fuel, fire under you? Yes, gives you a yes, I'm going to practice. This is what I want to do. For me, in my early years of practice, I was greatly inspired by seeing other practitioners. And so I saw how they were. I said, that is impressive. That really speaks to me. It resonated with some deep inner sense of goodness and peace. There's something. It was like, wow. And so I got so much inspiration to practice having those people as examples and models. And so I applied myself. I'm going to do it too. Sometimes where the inspiration comes from, that faith, and this is from doing the practice. I wanted to say, sometimes we say, I just did it out of faith without knowing it was going to work. I guess that expression in English sometimes means, I don't know if it works, but I just taking my chances. But, you know, we just do it. And then at some point, we experience something, we see something for ourselves. This works. Oh, that's how it is. So to see, for example, that, and this is one of the examples given in these ancient texts, to see, for example, that you get angry about something. And to know that usually you obsess about what you're angry with and you get head off on the highways and byways of blame and resentment. And but to see it arise and say, I don't need to do that now. And let it just pass right through. And then experience in the wake of that a quieter mind, a more peaceful mind. To wildly paraphrase the ancient texts, for the ancient people, that's a wow moment. Wow. I had that once on retreat when I was doing walking meditation in a hallway of a retreat center. And you know, you stake out your walking meditation path. And so I had my little place in the hallway and I was walking back and forth happily. And then I could see when I was walking down one direction, that someone else was coming, very long hallway, someone else was coming down the hallway, kind of in my lane. And I thought, certainly the person knows I'm here and will go around and, around me and wherever the person's going. So, you know, pretty confident in that. So I kept walking back and forth and then the person entered into my lane. And the person, what's the person doing there? This is my lane. And heat and anger arose. And the heat and anger arose, and I could feel it rise up. It rose up, and it just kept going and left me. It was like I had a Teflon mind. It didn't stick anywhere. And so, you know, I still was angry, but the idea that I didn't grasp it or hold on to it, that was a wow moment. Wow. To have those kinds of experiences is, in the ancient texts, considered one of the primary sources of having confidence in the Dharma. It means that you see something for yourself. Directly. You know it for yourself. Wow, if I didn't grab onto that, it passed away. I practiced and practiced. Eventually it dissipated. Wow, it's not here anymore. I don't have to be stuck in those things. In other words, faith in the Dharma, actually it says faith in the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, isn't some abstract belief that the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha is wonderful and you have to believe it somehow. But it arises out of seeing little movements of freedom in your own mind. And it might be very small ones. It might be you're downstairs in that meal line, maybe the next meal, and that line is pretty long if you're at the end of it. And one option is to start composing an angry letter to the authorities at IRC and explain to them this doesn't work to have long lines, and we have important practice to do, and we have to get, you know, eat quickly so we can really do the liberating practice up in the hall, and we shouldn't be kind of, you know, be forced to stand there and when we have important things to do. So that you can get carried away, right? And then you can say, well, wait a minute, let me be mindful of this, what's going on here? And then look at it carefully and say, wait a minute, you know, it just occurred to me, I really want to be liberated. Maybe this is the moment. Why should I reserve it only for the meditation hall? Maybe I can let go of needing to be quick. Maybe I can let go of needing to hurry back to meditate more. What happens if I take this moment to be the meditation? And the resentment, the anger just goes away, and the concern goes away, and you find yourself just completely present, as if it's nothing else that ever needs to happen, just standing in line and taking a few steps forward, standing a few steps forward. And it just becomes kind of precious to be there. That might seem like pedestrian and mild, but that's an example of the kind of insights that give birth to a certain kind of confidence and trust. Wow. Now let's extrapolate this. If this is possible standing in line, maybe it's possible in many endeavors in life, many situations. Maybe it's possible in all situations. Maybe the mind that I have that's afraid and anxious and angry, greedy, lustful, maybe I'm not stuck in it. Maybe it's workable. Maybe the practice can help me with this, find my freedom and release from it. And then to be inspired by that, to have confidence in that, to have trust in that, to have faith in that possibility, I'm going to really do this practice. To know that this is possible, yes. And no one has to tell me how good, you know, that Buddhism is good, you should do it. I know this for myself. This kind of faith that the tradition calls, they use a different word than sada. They use the expression avecha pasada. And this means, pasada means a kind of faith which is clear, pure, and bright. Pasada means clear, pure, bright, those kinds of meanings to it. And it refers to a kind of faith. So it's not zealot, it's not full of zeal and fervor, the faith. It's a kind of faith that's peaceful and clear. It's like the muddy water has been, the mud has settled, and now the water is clear. So there's something about, ideally in Buddhism, about this sada, pasada, these two kinds of faith, that help the mind become quieter, clearer, less agitated, and certainly not fiery. And then this pasada version, it's faith based on understanding, based on personal experience. Sometimes it's called verified faith. And in my early years of practice, if someone had told me that just letting go of my impatience standing in a line was kind of like pointing to some essential, important aspect of the Dharma, I wouldn't have believed them. Because I thought it was, you know, some kind of great cosmic experience of oneness, or I don't know what I thought, but I don't think I was really thinking it was anything. I wasn't that smart. I just thought it was great. But it wasn't, you know. And so, but it's that simple. But it's that simple done in all circumstances of our life. It's that simple done with the big issues of our life. Sickness, old age, and death. Security, safety that we're concerned with. The possibility is to apply this and find it's where life is workable. There's a path, there's a practice to go through that can help us become free. And no matter what circumstance we find ourselves in, that freedom can be found. And if you find yourself in situations that conventionally are catastrophic, you're given a diagnosis of cancer out of the blue. And then you remember, this is terrible. But I do have this practice. I really trust it. I think now's the time to rely on it. And I've known people who only really kind of said, you know, applied themselves in the practice when they were up against something like that. And they were felt so lucky that they had discovered the basics of practice, and they kind of dabbled in it in a while until, okay, this is how I'm going to address this. I'm going to really work through this. And I've seen people work through some of the deepest fears and deepest concerns with a practice and come out the other side. Some of the most beautiful ones that I've seen are actually people who end up dying. They died healed, even though they didn't die cured. So sometimes, if you're going to die anyway, it's better to die healed. It's a powerful thing to do. So this practice of mindfulness that, you know, I use the example of, you know, your impatience in the line, is designed to help us, support us in the most challenging and difficult times of our life. So being on retreat is a journey. And there are times in the journey when it's uphill and you have to work hard in manual labor. Times on the journey it's downhill, just a breeze and just cruising down. Times you just happen to be coincidentally coasting downhill. Who knows what? You come in and sit down. It's like, shoo, wow. And you pat yourself on the back and say, I nailed it. I know how to do this now. You come back to the next sitting and it's completely the opposite end. It's hard work. What happened? I'm supposed to know how to do this. Don't take so much credit, but also don't do the opposite. Don't take all the blame either. Don't be so responsible as to only be responsible for putting together the conditions. So in terms of this faith, is there some way that you can be supported by something that you have confidence in here? Is there some way that you can reflect and think and no matter what happens here, there's something here for me. I have a practice. I have an experience, this, you know, what Gil talked about, that gives me personal verified confidence, but I've known some practitioners that really inspired me. Or for some people, those teachings, Buddhist teachings that I read, I've never read anything that made so much sense before. That's, for the time being, I'm going to rely on the confidence that I have in that until I see it for myself. It helps me a lot to have confidence in this practice because the practice keeps telling me, the teachings tell me, I'm supposed to discover it for myself. It's sooner or later, I'm supposed to have my own verified experience. Oh, this works. So faith, is there an attitude of faith or confidence or trust that you can support you here? The reason I like the word trust is that for me, when I think of trust or trusting, it feels like I'm giving space for what's here. It allows me. Confidence gives me energy to practice. Trust gives me an attitude of being open and receptive. I just trust here. So part of what I do is to allow what's here to unfold with trust. And I know what the opposite is like, to fight against what's happening, to complain about what's happening, to be overwhelmed by what's happening, to be resentful about what's happening, to be confused by what's happening, all kinds of things we can do. But to shift, is it realistically possible, not pretending, it's realistically possible to tap into some movement inside of trust where the gesture of the hands going out wide and the chest being open, say, here I am, I'll be with this. Do you have that you can offer what's happening here? That's allowing for the conditions, that's putting a condition in place that allows the journey to unfold in a good way. Finally, I want to say that in a sense, that's an attitude that we try to bring forth to support us. in the process of doing that, it might not be so easy to stay connected to a positive attitude like that. That's okay. What we're trying to do here in this practice is see what is happening. So if you try to have this positive attitude of trust, what it might reveal is how much you can't do it. And you start discovering some of the attitudes you do carry with you. And to have some of the underground attitudes revealed is a path to freedom. Is part of which, the ideal thing would be that you see all the shenanigans of your mind, all the things which you don't want to look at, and you see it, and you say, great, I know that it's good to see this, finally. The way forward is to know this stuff, as opposed to, oh, not again. You know, I'm bad. Rather, yes. Go like, yes, here it is. And there's a lot of subtle attitudes that can go on that you want to be able to notice. One attitude that I had when I was in early years of practice was that if it's happening to me, it's not the real thing. I didn't know I had this attitude. It was just kind of operating in the background. But no matter what happened to me, it didn't count. And so I was undermining myself all the time. All the time. And took a while to see that. And when I saw it clearly, it still would arise, but then I would just smile at it. There you are. Another attitude was kind of related to that, was the grass is greener on the other side of the fence. Everyone else was having a better experience than me, a better version of it, whatever. And so I was always kind of in this comparing myself to other people and just constantly doing that. Another attitude is, I'm supposed to be successful in what I do. I can't fail. And that can be an insidious kind of attitude that also undermines this stuff. Another subtle attitude could be that life is full of dangers. I have to be really alert. There's peril everywhere. And some people who... It's only by being quiet and still on retreat that we see that actually there's an attitude of fear that's underlying everything, every perception, every thought. There's a fear there. Or there's an underlying aversion to things. Everywhere I go, I seem to be looking at what's wrong with things. So one of the things that happens on this kind of practice is we start seeing those kinds of things. And it's not a mistake to see those. It doesn't mean that you're a bad person. It's in this funny way in which the logic of practice is different than ordinary life, it's time to celebrate. Yep, there it is. I'm sure glad I see it finally. It's a little bit discouraging to see it, but I have a practice. And this practice was designed to address this. And then to have confidence in the practice. Okay, let's get to work. Let's be mindful. Let's look at it. Let's learn how to be free of it. Not by getting rid of it, but by not contracting around it, reacting to it so much, not using it as a way to beat ourselves up. What happens if I just let the fear just be there? A powerful thing to do in practice when you're afraid, is to help your fear feel safe. Help your fear feel safe. Don't make yourself feel safe. Help your fear feel safe. And the primary thing it needs to be safe from is you. Let it be there. Allow it to be there. It wants to be safe. It wants to be able to be there without someone attacking it or fixing it or pushing it away or feeling bad. And just hold it in mindfulness. And to have the confidence, the trust, that it's okay just to hold with attention these things that are difficult inside. Let's just breathe with it. Let's hold it. Let's be with it. Can you call upon your confidence, your trust, your faith just enough so that you don't have to react to the difficulties, but you can hold them? And I'm doing this gesture with my hands, cupping my hands together, because that's the image that I use for when there's difficulty. I kind of imagine the awareness, the mindfulness, comes from underneath and just holds the things that are difficult, as opposed to poking at them or, you know, jackhammering them or analyzing them, or because then the fear just gets more afraid. But just whatever it is, the anger, just hold it there. Hold it there. But that takes some modicum of confidence, some modicum of trust or faith that it's worthwhile to do that. Many people have never learned that in their life. They learned the opposite. And so it's actually a very radical thing, difficult thing to learn. But it's for some people, it's a huge paradigm shift in their life to be able to relate to things with mindfulness, with just being present for it, finding their way by just paying attention to what's there, and not succumbing to all the other messages we've learned about how we should relate, what it means, and what we should do, and criticizing ourselves. So I imagine that for you here to come on retreat like this, you had to have some modicum of faith or trust or confidence, because it's a big deal to come here. I was really impressed how well you sat today. The sittings I sat in here, it felt pretty still. I didn't hear a lot of restlessness, and didn't hear a lot of a lot of the challenges that can often be on retreat the first day. Maybe they were here for you, but somehow it seemed pretty settled and quiet. It's pretty impressive what you've done for today. I really appreciate what you've done. I don't think it was an easy thing to do. The first day of retreat can be difficult. But I think there had to be some modicum, some minimum degree of confidence in something, this practice, for you to have done what you've done so far today. So you have it, I might guess. And if it's there, the suggestion is, in terms of these five faculties, that call on it more. Not with big expectations, but just as something, it's like the nourishment of the plant. It's like the water that you're going to pour on the plant so the plant can grow. You don't grow the plant of the Dharma, but you create the conditions for it. So the conditions of faith, of confidence, of trust, of allowing, making space for what's there, holding it kindly, and being patient so that things can unfold in their own time. Thank you all very much.